you told us only through you could we know God. And if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who've sacrificed the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when they cut this ball and chain. You who sacrificed the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth, future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
The opinions expressed on corporations and democracy are those of our guests and the hosts, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for October 20th, 2022. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. In today's program, we'll be discussing the risks to democracy in the November midterm elections coming up in just 2.5 weeks, and the state of election integrity and voting rights going into the election. Our guest is Professor Phil Worf from the Department of Political Science at local Mendocino College. Phil's voice has been heard in recent years on Fifth Fridays with host Bob Bashansky's program Politics, a Love Story, which is currently on hiatus. So Eddie and I snuck in and stole him fair and square for our program today to get him back on the air. So a shout out to Bob for getting Phil on the air in the first place several years ago, and we're glad to have him here with us this evening. Phil Worf has been a professor of political science at Mendocino College for 15 years. Prior to coming to Mendo, he taught part-time at the University of Arizona while doing public opinion consulting. And from 1995 to 2003, he worked in Washington, D.C., conducting polling for campaigns, companies, and interest groups at Greenberg Quinlan Research. And finally, at a public opinion research program affiliated with the University of Maryland. His master's degree is in international studies from the University of South Carolina. So let's have a look at risks to democracy in the November midterms and the state of election integrity and voting rights. Phil Worf, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon.
And evening, too, on top of
evening,
that.
Evening, yes, whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
You're used to being on in the mornings in past years.
Right. Well, glad to join you this evening.
So let's just do a quickie on the midterms covers House and Senate races. For the House, it's every 2 years. For the Senate, it's every 6 years. So we have about, what is it, two-thirds of senators up for re-election or something like that?
You mean in terms of the Senate?
Yeah, the Senate, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, I think a third of those particular parts of the, since the part of the plus of the different can you tell me something else?
Yeah, well, sure. we've got about one third of the Senate up for re-election, and about is it every 2 years for the House? So there's just hundreds of seats up for the House. And so getting into the threats to basic democracy the country is facing, there is just, a long list of them, which we want to start on. Many of them on the coattails of the big lie, such as the Senate race in Arizona. I know that's of concern. So there are several Senate races which are going to be crucial for the upcoming midterms, and some of them very involved in some of the shenanigans that go on with voter integrity, election integrity, and all. So can we have a look at some of those in the Senate races?
What are some of the races that you think are the most exciting or alarming, or however you would put it, the closest, where there's the most at stake?
You're talking about Senate?
Yes.
Yeah, so for the Senate, I know that there's a list we have right now. There's somebody recently published. Actually, this is from Paste Magazine recently. Mm-hmm. And they did a little list of the 10 top races in the Senate to watch, and they put them in order of the likeliness that they'll flip. And so the one at the top of their list is Nevada. And so what do we know about the election security and voter suppression, anything else going on in Nevada?
Well, I mean, there's a number of races for the Senate, and it looks like Nevada is the most important one in terms of the closest election in Nevada, and it's pretty close, pretty even. I think the Democrats were doing pretty well earlier in the season, earlier in the year, particularly after the Supreme Court decision about abortion rights, and so it's been some challenges there. But I was looking at like Wisconsin and Senator Johnson there, and against Mandela Barnes. Looks like that Wisconsin's going to Senator Johnson's going to keep Wisconsin probably. But I think that Pennsylvania is probably going to be good for the Democrats. I think Mehmet Oz is probably not going to be able to win, and John Fetterman, the Democrat, will hold on. Probably right now he's got a 5-point lead. I think the Democratic candidate, current senator, is going to win that race most likely. It looks like Herschel Walker is not going to be able to pull it out ultimately, I don't think. I think those are really kind of the tough ones. Although I have to say North Carolina and Virginia also very close as well, and so all those races are going to be pretty tight. I don't know what that means in terms of what it's going to look like in terms of how many pros and cons you can make, and how many decisions might result from different candidates or different Senate seats. And so there's a few open seats, North Carolina, Ohio, and they could be successful, but it looks right now it's just very, very close. And I think those few seats will be really tough. But I think that the sort of 10 of these top ones here, I think about five or six of them will be where those choices of those particular candidates will be taken right up until the end of the elections, and we'll be very close, and we'll see what happens. I think two months ago, the Democrats would have been much better in terms of being able to pull, to win perfectly, and not so much for the anymore. In that case, there's a lot more less support for for Democrat candidates, and those have been declining for a little bit over the last few weeks. So pretty big challenge. I think I don't know. I think it's probably going to be pretty close. Right now there's a little bit of about 60% of the likelihood is going to be for Democrats that probably going to go ahead and keep the Senate. But right now it's not completely clear whether that'll happen or not, but looking pretty good relative to enough seats to at least sort of keep half the Senate, between the two parties. So it'll be very interesting to see.
One of the things about the Senate race, at least they're more exposed and get a lot more press, so that when Herschel Walker or Dr. Oz or something do some acting out in public, people are more apt to notice it, and it might help the Democrats in those cases. I guess there's five MAGA Republicans in New Hampshire, Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Ohio who have been a little reflected sort of outlandish in the press, so that might help the Democrats in those races, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats are going to be pretty successful, I would think, in Georgia. I don't think that Herschel Walker is going to be able to keep that. I think, Mr. Oz is not going to be successful in Pennsylvania. I don't believe John Fetterman will do better. I think, Michigan was very close. I think that actually Lieutenant Governor Mandel Barnes is not going to catch, I don't think, Senator Johnson, which is unfortunate. But I think that, North Carolina is very close, Ohio is very close, and I think it's possible that, Democrats could win those seats. And, it's a few weeks, a couple of weeks away anyway, a few weeks away, and we'll see what happens. But I think, it's those key races that will determine the result, and it's not clear exactly what that's going to look like just yet.
And I guess it could take a while to find out, even after the election. Like if there's a runoff in Georgia, it could go on until the end of the year.
Right, that's true. Yeah. I mean, I think I really don't know what the surveys look like in terms of which side is doing better and how much. But yeah, I think it has to be 50%, right? And if they don't get a 50%, then they start over for another for January. But I don't think that's going to be a major problem. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, the some listeners will certainly remember a year and a half ago, pushing 2 years ago, when the runoff occurred in Georgia, and it was for two races, the same state. And and that is possible. Again, there is I haven't seen mentioned the third candidate in Georgia. So apologies to listeners there. I don't know who it is. But there was apparently three running. And so a plurality, whoever gets the most votes under 50%, will not win the race. So if no candidate gets 50% plus one, then there will be a runoff between the top two candidates, which is what happened 2 years ago, and that's when so much attention was on Georgia. It was January of 2001, just a few minutes after the general election, the presidential election, when that runoff occurred and got so much attention nationwide. So do you want us to shift over to the House, and then we can talk about some of the risks to democracy in these races?
Can I say one more thing about the Senate? My understanding is the Republicans need a net gain of one seat to flip the Senate. So I just wanted to put that in there because it's a little edgy.
Yeah, indeed.
And how close it's going to be, and whether the Democrats can actually gain a seat or two. And there's about 60% is the estimate of Democrats staying in the in charge of the Senate, and we can, you know, see that some based on some of the data that's come in, some of the polling information, and you know, it looks like that Democrats might be able to gain a seat, and that would put them to, you know, have a majority in the Senate, which would be really helpful. Right now, it looks like the House is going to be a little more trouble. But I think it's really fascinating that, you know, how close the Senate is, and how there, you know, those five or six real contests under you know, under the you know, the current system. There'll be some, you know, these will be very close results at the end of the, you know, November. So, but I don't really know right now who's going to be, you know, how that's going to happen. The Democrats were being much better a couple of months ago, but now it seems like they're just not getting, you know, they're, you know, via the abortion decision by the Supreme Court and other things, but we're just not gonna, I don't think the Democrats, you know, I think those that has lasted long enough to where it's the focus of it has been declined, and then you'll see focus on other things, the economy and so forth, that's gonna, you know, really challenge those things. And so, you know, is that gonna ultimately help the Democrats, you know, with those, dealing with those issues or not? And it's not clear exactly how that's going to turn out at the moment.
Mm-hmm. You did mention, I think, but it's four out of the five Republicans running in these top 10 crucial races are, you know, Trumpers or election deniers, or, you know, call them what you will. So these people are in some of the hot races, and that has a potential to become a fundamental threat to democracy if they do win the Senate by chance.
Okay, we'll talk about that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Well, no, I was just saying that, you know, this is a big deal, but, you know, only a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. And so right now, fortunately for the Democrats, there's, you know, the challenges are going to be more, or the seats are going to be more on behalf of, you know, elected Democrats, and typically they're, you know, those elections. And so, you know, we'll see if the Senate's able to hold on to, the Democrats are able to hold on to the, you know, the Senate. And it seems like right now they might be able to, doesn't seem like they're going to be able to keep the House. And so this would sort of mean, you know, it'd be very difficult to get things done as the Democratic, you know, and for the Senate and for the House.
Yeah, as the saying goes, difficult to get things done. That is, some of the recent reports in the news have been about those issues, that the Democrats may have peaked earlier than they would have wanted to. But now the Republicans are driving with crime and the economy and using that against the Democrats all they can. So that is it's possible that the momentum for the be waning, but we'll see with 6 weeks to go, or I'm sorry, almost 3 weeks to go. And there has been commentary in the news that I've read. Here's one quote: that the House races are shaping up in Republicans' favor. And another quote is, to win control of the House, Republicans need to pick up five seats on net, and they might gain three of those from redistricting alone, which brings us to the gerrymandering issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's really interesting is that, you know, being able to create to create districts that benefit one party or the other is easy to do, and because of recent Supreme Court decisions limiting the ability of the government or the Justice Department, and, you know, sort of keeping those keeping some of that some of those things fixed, right? But we have you know, a situation via gerrymandering where, for example, back in the early 2000s, you had a situation in Texas, for example, where the Democrats were able to keep the state legislature in the 2000, and then by 2002, the local, the Texas election Republicans took control of the state legislature, and they changed the system so that they redrew the boundaries. You don't have to wait until the census is ready. They redrew the boundaries and everything. And so it went from, you know, Democrats having a majority of those state level of the congressional districts, and then moved immediately much less for the for the Democrats, right, and much more for the Republicans, who were able to gain quite a bit of seats based on the redrawing of the congressional districts. And if you look at 2004, the only increase in Republicans in the state or in the legislature and Congress, that went immediately for +3 based on the distribution of distribution of representatives from Texas. And so, you know, using gerrymandering to create districts that benefit the party in charge of the state legislature is particularly, it's common, it's not illegal or anything like that, but there's a way to really benefit one party or relative to the other by simply redrawing those boundaries. It usually happens after the census, but you don't have to wait till the next census. And, you know, it does happen if there's a switch.
Mm-hmm. In Texas, then, there could actually be a higher Democratic vote, but the Republicans would win.
Yeah, I mean, we have a situation in some states where, Wisconsin, for example, Democrats can actually get more votes nationwide and do much better, except for the way the districts are drawn, both the congressional districts and also the districts within state, that you could actually have Democrats win up to 55% of the vote or something, but the way the districts are drawn, they could still end up with a fairly limited number of seats and a significant domination of those seats by the Republicans. And so this whole gerrymandering thing is really huge. And given the decisions that have been made recently by the Supreme Court, limiting the ability of the Justice Department to actually go after this kind of gerrymandering that might be generated by some, racial perspectives and that kind of stuff. It's a big deal, and it can really determine the outcome of, who's in charge of a particular state and how many people you can elect into a congressional office. It's really unfortunate that gerrymandering is so common and, something that's gotten more significant over time. And it really sort of undermines, to some degree, the democratic outcome of elections. And, that's just the way it is. There's, so much conflict between the two parties.
Yeah, it's really very striking. I know we've been talking about how polarized it's been, but typically, the United States, the elections, they would go to the right and then to the left, to the right, kind of bounce back and forth, but I've never seen it like this before, where it would go so far to the right. It's just, it takes my breath away.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of the fundamental health of democracy, one of the recent comments is from the Republican candidate for Senate in Arizona, who said that she would very gladly accept the election results if she wins.
And that seems to be.
And no comment about any other option. So, right. What do you think the risks are in the state of Arizona?
Well, I don't know. It is interesting. I think Carrie Lake, the Republican nominee, she was asked, "Would you accept the results?" And she said, "Well, yeah, if I win, right?" So mm-hmm. that's really scary, actually, that that's the case. And you have to wonder, it's a very, very close, in terms of what we see right now polling. And you just have to wonder if, in fact, she doesn't win, that there is the possibility then that she would claim some kind of, inappropriate cheating or something like that, mm-hmm. or a lack of you know, counting correctly and this kind of thing. And so, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but if she loses the election but decides that she's going to challenge it, and then you have the state legislature, which is heavily Republican, who knows exactly about how that's going to turn out. But I think it is very concerning to me that you have people like Kari Lake running for governor who simply reject the loss of you know, of Trump in 2020, and this raises a big question as to whether you know, if Republicans lose in 2024, what exactly does that mean, and are there going to be efforts to keep from, you know, to go against the result and try to keep, you know, Republicans in power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some instances, the state legislature or others would be able to influence that outcome. And so that's a big concern for me, really. And what happens if you get to the end of the campaign and all of a sudden the, you know, the Republican nominee decides that they don't believe that they lost the election when, if they did? And, you know, how's that going to work out? And are we going to be able to, you know, to keep our system and maintain the democratic portion of it, but or maintain the fundamental democracy of it? But that's being challenged by Republicans who don't, you know, have that and are willing to sort of reject the idea of having object to losing and making claims that there's some problem with it, when in fact that's not the case. Particularly in 2020, that was the case. Mm-hmm. You have to be careful, you know, what's going to happen in these instances. It's not clear.
Let me mention to listeners, we're speaking about the risks to democracy in the November midterms and the state of election integrity and voting rights going into the midterms. We're speaking with Phil Wharf, professor of political science at Mendocino College. I wanted to mention, as next, consider the who actually does the vote counting, which brings us to the topic of secretaries of state. Would you like to comment on that nationwide?
Well, it's really interesting because secretary of states, in most states, they're actually the person who would count the votes and, you know, make sure that the vote was counted correctly and the winners are put into place properly. In most cases, the state legislature or the secretary of state will do that. So we have to look at, there's a couple of about 10 or 12 important races where you actually have Republicans who have been nominated to do this, who are very conservative and pro-Trump, and they believe that, you know, it's possible then that the outcome could be rejected, manipulated, et cetera, something like that by the Secretary of State. And that's a big concern. And the other thing, too, is that the state legislature in many states, I think they could just sort of replace the, send a different slate of electors if they want to in some instances. So this is a big challenge in terms of, you know, what exactly the impact is going to be on political outcomes.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that sticks in my mind is about secretaries of state being elected in most states, but not all states. In right. Some states, they are appointed by the governor. And I believe that Pennsylvania is in the is being highlighted for that, and that's because whoever wins the governorship may appoint who they wish as Secretary of State, which will affect how votes are counted and the fundamental election integrity in the state. Can you comment on that?
Well, there's a number of states where, you know, you have this Secretary of State who's able to, you know, determine outcomes or make decisions about it. And these are pretty important things. I mean, you know, one of the things that they want to do if they win, they're promising they want to have eliminate voting machines and have voting by hand, mm-hmm. which probably is more dangerous than actually using voting machines in terms of having correct representation of the outcome, you know, and voting by voting by hand or counting by hand, it would take a super long time and really doesn't make any sense at all. But there's that. They want to be able to some like running some governor candidates want to take away those powers from the Secretary of State and make that into the governor's office and or the state legislature as well. So you know, these are this is a big concern that you're going to have these you know, people who are partisan and who are going to run these important Secretary of State offices that run elections. And so, can we, given the fact that there's sort of this rejection of political outcomes, you know, is that going to be a problem after 2022? And it's not clear. It could be a serious problem, and if it's close enough, I think it will be. There'll be a lot of challenge to those, and how exactly that turns out is going to be, you know, is I'm curious about and concerned about.
The fun one to remember, of course, is the original battle between Kemp and Stacey Abrams, where he was Secretary of State running against her for governor, and he got to count his own votes. That's just so classic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. I mean, I think that Kemp, when he was when he was Secretary of State, had a big purge of voters, of the voter pool, and so people who hadn't voted in the last 6 years or something were all, you know, bounced. And so this was, as Secretary of State, he had the ability to influence the political outcome of the gubernatorial election, and you know, certainly benefited from that. You know, I think he's actually probably doing better this time than last time in terms of you know, running for re-election. Stacey Abrams, I don't think is going to be able to knock him off. But yeah, I mean, you know, secretaries of state have the ability to really influence elections and election outcomes and election process, like how many voting locations they're going to have, whether you can do mail-in balloting, and how much, what's required on mail-in balloting, and that kind of thing. You know, so, you know, some states are trying to put in place a situation where you have to be really specific in terms of putting dates down, or, you know, writing your signature as the ballots and all this stuff. So it's making mail-in ballots much more difficult, because I think there's a belief on the Republican side that that's one of the reasons they lost in 2020, was it was just too easy for people to vote via mail. And I think that's that ability is going to be restricted fairly significantly in a number of states.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me to mention a couple of headlines just recently about this issue. Although, let me again remind listeners that we're speaking with Phil Worf, professor of political science at Mendocino College. If you would like to get in with a question or comment on the air, the number to call here is 895-2448. That's in area code 707-895-2448. And let me also remind listeners that we are in the middle of our fall pledge drive. And so if you would like to donate in appreciation of the program, you're not able to call in to do it in the evening hours like this, but you can go to the website kzyx.org and press the big red button and donate online. Or you can, of course, send in a check to P.O. Box 1 in Philo, and we do have our first call coming in. Hello, caller. You are live on the air. What's your first name, and from where are you calling?
Gregory. And I'm wanting to comment on what I think is a pretty clear leadership on the Republican side for regime change. I mean, we hear regime change in third world type of agencies led by the militarists, but it would seem to me that it's very clear. And so what I would like to know, if the folks are participating in this discussion, if that is what's going on, if that's the diagnosis, what's the treatment? How do we, at this point, a few weeks before an election, which we pretty well know is going to be managed and denied and all such as that, and with all sorts of difficulty of being able to regularize the count, etc., how do we deal with this? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
What a good question.
Yeah, Phil, did you hear that clearly?
How do we deal with the possibility of someone cheating, basically? And one of the things the Democratic Party is doing is they're trying to recruit and have recruited a number of people who are going to be poll watchers, just to make sure that as much as possible, wherever they're able to see that the tally of votes is correct, and just be able to observe that process. And but I also think that the Republicans have done a lot more, especially people who support President Trump, a lot more to try to get involved in overseeing or trying to influence election outcomes, mainly by trying to make it harder for people to vote, by making it harder to register, and doing a number of other things like that. And really, there's not much that can be done about it except for good poll watching and making sure that the rules are followed, and if there's anything unusual, that they take some action. The Republicans have got a better system right now of following up on who's voted, who hasn't voted, and what potential problems there are, and that kind of thing. But the Democrats don't quite have that set up. But there's going to be some oversight of this fairly significantly on both sides.
The caller used early in his comment, he used the word organized, and with some reluctance, I have to refer to, I think it was Mark Twain's comments, and it's over 100 years ago, about being involved with an organized party, and he commented, "Well, I'm a Democrat. That's not an organized party."
right.
And the Republicans are better at specific talking points, using the talking points nationwide. Everybody using this kind of thing. I mean, they're just more organized about that.
Yeah.
And as well, the talking points are often a bunch of hooey, I think, but they stick to them well. So it's up to the electorate whether they're going to fall or not, or whether they're going to fall for it or not. And that's the way it is. I wanted to mention an article related to what you mentioned a couple of minutes ago. It's called "Stop the Steal Supporters: Train Thousands of U.S. Poll Observers." This is out of Reuters on October 13th, and it talks about the in the final stretch to the midterm. Reuters has documented multiple incidents of intimidation involving an expanding army of election observers, many of them recruited by prominent Republican Party figures and activists, echoing Trump's false theories about election fraud. So there's some evidence that they'll be the Republicans will be outnumbering the Democrats when it comes to observing polling places and such.
Yeah, I think that's true. We're definitely going to see that. It's interesting. I used to live in Arizona, and one of the things that conservatives would do, they would show up at polls in heavily Latino areas with sort of official looking shirts on, with guns. So they look kind of like they're police officers or something or whatever. And their main focus was to intimidate people to try to limit as much voting participation as possible. So there's lots of different ways to try to intimidate voters, both before and then sort of figuring out if you can go after voters afterwards in terms of whether they filled out their ballots completely and this kind of thing. And I think, mail ballots are particularly difficult because if the state really wants to, they can create a situation where you really have to be specific on your mail-in ballot. If there's anything wrong, they can be rejected, even if it's something that is not what the courts would say not material or is immaterial to it. There's no reason why, if you get your ballot in on time, there's no reason why you should have to put the date on it, or no reason why not putting a date on it would cause it to be rejected when if it gets there on time, what difference does it make when it was set? So there's lots of different things like this. And for example, in Texas, they made some changes and they found that, the number of ballots that were thrown out was about 1 in 8. So about 12% of ballots were tossed out in the recent Texas primaries, which sort of indicates how significant that would be relative to voting outcomes. Yeah. So
that is huge. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's really a big concern. Now, I mean, you know, Republicans in Texas say, well, look, there's been these other elections and it got better after that. But these elections that they claim were better, and they were better in terms of just thrown out ballots, but we're talking about races that are not statewide races or congressional races or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So those who are opposed to this new set of policies aren't very convinced that you know, there's not going to be the same kind of thing happen in 2024.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something kind of weird what's happening in the news in Florida, that people were actually arrested for voting. I gather they were either black or Democrat or both.
Yeah, I don't know about the details of that, actually, but the governor, he appointed a person who's the charge of the election police, right? And so this person is in charge of the election police is a big time Republican partisan, and so and also someone who's denies that Biden won the election. So we're talking about a situation where you're really going to have pushback against results here, and it seems like instead of the interest being to make sure that people the voting is legal and this kind of thing, it's more just trying to make it more difficult for people who are less likely to vote, or for people who vote and just make a mistake about not filling in one thing on the form, even though it's pretty clear if you look at it that the vote is legitimate. And so I think those things are going to be the way to, you know, and making it harder to register and all that are ways that the leftist vote is going to be kept as small as possible, and particularly in, you know, conservative states where they can make these laws fairly easily, Texas being a great example of that.
Yeah. Pennsylvania comes up again, and it's relative to this mail-in voting and putting a date on your ballot. Let me mention again, though, that's 895-2448 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. 895-2448, and of course area code 707. This is a quote from an article from The Lever, and just October 11th, so last week. But this is on Tuesday of that week. The Supreme Court vacated an appellate court decision, and as a result, Pennsylvania counties may be able to reject timely ballots cast by eligible registered voters if the voter forgot to date their mail ballot envelopes. And as trivial as that sounds, what actually happened there, there's a third U.S. Court of Appeals had ruled that counties cannot reject the otherwise valid ballots because they're simply missing a date. And that's because the court found that the date next to the signature on your envelope is immaterial, since it was not used to determine the timeliness of the ballot. And the Voting Rights Act, remember that, from 1964, I believe it was, it actually clearly prohibits states from rejecting ballots for immaterial reasons. So the court issue became, like, apparently, what is immaterial? And the Supreme Court overruled Pennsylvania, and so people that forget to put the date on their envelope can be rejected.
Yeah, I mean, the Voting Rights Act has been severely, it's been eviscerated for the most part by the Supreme Court with Section 5 getting rid of sort of the Justice Department, Federal Justice Department pre-clearance of redistricting of the former Confederacy. And so what's happened, so the Supreme Court says, well, we don't really have enough data anymore to know about this, which I'm not sure they're really paying attention. But so this gives the states that formerly had to get clearance the ability to make districts that they want. And, you know, again, a place like Texas, we're looking at a situation where you can just, or in North Carolina is another good example, if who's in charge is able to draw the boundaries the way they want to, the Republicans would be able to go from like 5 seats out of 13 to 9 seats out of 14, which is which North Carolina got a new seat in Congress. And the North Carolina Supreme Court keeps saying, no, you can't do that. You're creating districts that don't represent the population. And, you know, so there's a, and the Supreme Court's sort of hesitant to get involved in these, whether the state Supreme Courts are making decisions. But it seems like with this new majority in the Supreme Court, perhaps they're changing their mind on that. and getting more involved in those, and that to restrict the ability of states and courts to go after politically oriented redistricting that sort of gives one party the big advantage over the other simply by the way the lines are drawn. You know, for example, in Alabama right now, there's a situation where, you know, I forgot the portion of Alabama that is African American, but it's like 35% or 40%, something like that. And they've only got one out of 8 or 9 congressional districts because the you know, they're drawn in a way that, you know, there's cracking and packing, right? So they pack all the African-American voters into as small a space as possible, and they crack up the rest of them into, you know, and whatever's left, it gets cracked up into a bunch of different districts, and thereby reducing the impact of African-American voters by keeping them into one congressional district. Yeah. I don't think there's going to be any limitation on that going forward.
I remember you covered this with Bob Bishansky in the spring. The issue was gerrymandering versus extreme gerrymandering, which is now it's a level not seen before, even when both parties have been doing it for generations, but it's just reached a new extreme. I'll mention one comment from the same article. This is a small compliment to Texas in this case. A Texas court ordered Bexar County to open at least 388 polling places on Election Day, ruling that number to be the minimum required under state law. The county had planned to open as few as 259. So that's almost half again the number of voting places they've been ordered to open, but they were trying to minimize that up until the court ordered that a few weeks ago. So I hope that actually happens, but we'll see. But for what it's worth, right, the court did something that sounds sensible for democracy in that case.
Yeah, I mean, to make it, to have that small a number of registration places or polling places is just absurd. I mean, it's clearly an attempt to limit the ability of people to actually go out and vote. And so it's good that the courts would intervene in that. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that states are doing. It's, you know, reducing polling place hours, making it harder to vote, early, putting more limitations, that are questionable related to mail-in ballots and all that. So it was a big effort in many states to just make it more difficult. And this is really, it's a bummer because, you know, we as a democratic country and a democratic system, the goal should be to get as many people involved as possible. And we know the people who are less likely to get involved are more likely to be Democrats, and also the way to make that those people who and it's a way to keep those people from getting involved who might otherwise get involved, and to benefit the Democrats. And, you know, of course, politically, you know, it makes sense. Maryland is a predominantly Democratic state. They're doing the same thing in terms of gerrymandering districts and and sort of making election laws that benefit the Democrats in certain ways. So it's mostly Republicans that are doing it, but there are a couple of Democratic states, too.
The Democrats have been known to gerrymander, but right now it does seem like the Republicans are on, like, this extreme mission. I heard that in Georgia has a new law that anyone can challenge voters, and that there's over 80 Republican actors that are going around challenging as many people as they can, and that over 300,000 Georgia voters have been challenged. And what does that mean when they go to the polls? Maybe they're blocked?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I forget what state it is, but one of the new people running for Secretary of State basically said, you know, I don't care. You know, I don't care if it's one person who challenges an election outcome. I'm willing to investigate. I'm willing to delay the certification of the outcome, all this stuff. So basically what could happen, and given these kind of policies, is that you could sort of stretch it out indefinitely via the courts, via, you know, lack of action. And so what does that mean in terms of who's going to cast their ballots, particularly for president and stuff like that? And we don't know the extent to which certain state legislatures would take action. You know, there's the big question of the, you know, the independent state legislature issue as well.
Ooh, there's a bag of worms. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, so the independent state legislature theory, the idea that state lawmakers are able to make decisions about voting and about district drawing and this kind of stuff. And so the independent state legislature theory literally takes that explicit language that talks about the state legislature and ultimately means they believe gives the state legislature the ability to determine the outcome of the presidential election in that state. And so it's interesting that this is something the courts have sort of rejected, but the Supreme Court now seems like there are four members who are interested in looking at this independent state legislature theory more closely, and if in fact they decide that the state legislature alone, given an explicit reading of the Constitution, has the ability to do that on its own without the governor, without the courts being involved, any of that, well, then all of a sudden that creates a very different dynamic in terms of the state legislature's power to simply ignore election results. And
so this could become the law of the land out of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we could have a situation where the court says, you know, right now in most states, the legislature does, you know, write the create the districts, but you also in most states, you have the executive branch has to sign off on it. You also have the ability in North Carolina, for example, you know, to challenge them. And the state constitution says that, you know, the state courts are able to compel the legislature to redraw those boundaries based on equity and that kind of thing. And if this interpretation is okayed by the Supreme Court, well, now you have a situation where the state legislature can make a decision however they want without any checks and balances whatsoever. And to me, this is an extremely dangerous idea for democracy itself. And so it concerns me a great deal that, you know, you have enough members of the Supreme Court to actually hear a case about this when it's been, you know, it was rejected as recently as 2015. So that reflects the, you know, the change in the Supreme Court brought about by the Trump appointments. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, with their decisions on abortion rights and other things that are pretty dramatic, I think we could see some embracement of this independent state legislature theory, which, again, is, you know, removes all checks and balances, and that's kind of not the way our system is supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you just really scared me now.
Well, you know.
Sorry about that.
If I may take a moment to put that in a little bit of historic perspective, I've mentioned before on the radio here, the drop the name Hiram Johnson, and you being not raised in California, might surprise you. He was the governor back in the progressive era of California, and he was the governor when the 17th Amendment was passed, 1912, ratified in 1913. And but until then, senators, U.S. senators, were chosen by legislatures, not by the voters. Mm-hmm. And so this independent state legislature theory is similar in that the legislature would then decide who won the federal elections for each state, not the voters. And
right.
Which is just, I mean, scary, but that's, it's, you know, it's analogous to what used to be done back in that era.
Well, that's right. And, you know, so in order to get past that, there had to be a constitutional amendment, you know, approved, mm-hmm. in order to you know, to strip the state legislature of this power of appointing senators, which is a great idea. But certainly, you know, there was historically state legislatures until 1913 did choose senators, and so is there a relationship there in terms of the ability of the state legislature to make those decisions about, you know, election law and so forth? Well, maybe so. We don't know what, you know, we recent decisions have found that this doesn't fly, but, you know, 2015 was a long time ago, and like a long, long time ago relative to where the courts are.
Indeed, that was a very conservative era of the court, which didn't get changed until the New Deal era.
Yeah, so we're about running out of time. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the ways voters can protect their votes?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really interesting, and I mentioned this to Steve before, which is that, you know, if it were absent a few important people, you know, we could have had a situation where, you know, there could have been a more significant and direct challenge to the election outcomes. You know, the Secretary of State in Georgia, for example, the governor of Arizona, a Republican who you know, approved of that result. A number of, you know, places that are going to, you know, where if you hadn't had people with, you know, ethics, they could have been a problem. And that's my concern about secretaries of state and these Trump appointees and others. Now, so what can you do? Well, the first thing you want to do is make sure you're still registered. A lot of, now, California doesn't have a big problem with that. But in a lot of states, one thing that's happening, and Kemp did this, Governor Kemp in Georgia did this, he basically purged the voter rolls significantly for people who hadn't voted in a recent election. So first thing you should do, and again, California's not bad about this, but make sure you're registered still. Okay, that certainly helps. And you know, there's lots of different ways to, there's ways to check. The Secretary of State's office has a website. You can look up your registration number. I think you can do it by your name too as well. There's a phone number you can call. So all kinds of ways you can confirm your registered, and also confirm that your absentee ballots, if you're getting them, the mail ballots will be sent to the right location. That's often very helpful. It's a problem for young voters. I see this all the time at the campus, is that they don't really have a place where, you know, they can get things sent like that, and so there's often an issue with where their home address is and should they get it and all that, and then for the students themselves, where the heck it went to. But you know, there was the Electoral Count Act that was passed in Congress, right, which has got some bipartisan support, which eliminates the whole, you know, which makes it clear that the vice president is just, you know, it does not have any official power here. Mike Pence being one of those people who you have to respect at least a little bit for, you know, being willing to follow the law instead of following Trump. I think somebody else you really have to have a lot of respect for is the person driving the car that didn't take Trump to the Capitol.
January 6th, yeah.
I mean, if that would have happened, it would be completely crazy. But there, you know, there are places, particularly in California, where you can find this information out. And, mm-hmm. You guys have the phone numbers and stuff, I think. But, mm-hmm. You know, a number of ways you can protect yourself.
Yeah, and I guess there's ways to track your ballot, too, to make sure it was counted on the Secretary of State website, I assume. And, we do have, we wrote down a couple numbers. The ACLU has a nonpartisan election protection hotline, which is 1-866-OUR-VOTE, O-U-R-V-O-T-E. 1-866 our vote. And the Democrats also have a voter hotline in California in case you feel like you're being intimidated at the polls, or you think that there's not enough ballots there, or the lines are too long, or there's something that doesn't look right. The Democrat hotline is 877-321-VOTE. That's 877-321-VOTE.
Okay, and
we'll say one more thing. The Secretary of State's office, the website is sos.ca.gov.
And so, how appropriate, SOS.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, I should put a shout out to the local elections office, who just does a bang up job. You know, it goes real smoothly. We got our ballots, I think it was a week ago, and you know, just goes very smoothly. No questions asked about how it goes. But other parts of the country are not as smooth, and some of these states I mentioned are the ones to watch. Again, the top Senate races are probably Nevada, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina, and
Ohio, yeah, is open one too. That'd be pretty close.
That's an open seat, right? Yeah, there were three open seats. You mentioned a couple. Ohio is an open seat. North Carolina is an open seat, and Pennsylvania is an open seat. So both John Fetterman and Mehmet Oz, I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name, hope I didn't butcher that, but
Dr. Oz.
Dr. Oz are both, you know, have not been in the office before, so there's no incumbent there.
Right. Well, there's some close elections, and also, as we were discussing briefly before, you know, some of these governors, you know, these are Senate races, but in some states, governors appoint the people who determine who's going to you know, that set the rules and determine outcomes.
Yep, yep.
And so that's a big concern in a number of states, including Pennsylvania, which is one of the hot governor's races right now.
Okay. Well, we need to wrap up. Thank you for being our guest, Phil Wharf from the college. And we'll see how things go. Maybe talk about the election in a month, see how things actually went. But again, thanks for being our guest here on